Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast, where we explore cutting-edge strategies to keep teams human-centered, drive innovation, and empower you with the tools and insights needed to help your team excel and thrive in today's changing world. Your host is Dane Groeneveld, a seasoned expert with over 20 years of experience enhancing team dynamics and innovation. Today, Dane is joined by Greg Wilton. Greg is a global learning and knowledge leader who helps organizations unlock human performance through the free flow of knowledge. With nearly two decades of Fortune 500 experience, he believes that simple, scalable learning cultures combined with connected knowledge ecosystems create the conditions where teams can embrace a true growth mindset. Tune in today to discover, first, that generative AI only works as well as the ground truth behind it. Greg explains why knowledge stewardship, defining what's accurate, updating it as reality changes, and preventing garbage in, garbage out must become a core organizational capability. Second, great AI outcomes start with great prompts and great leadership. They'll explore how the structure of an effective prompt mirrors how strong leaders set expectations with clear roles, desired outcomes, constraints, and feedback. Better prompts equal better AI, which leads to better teamwork. And finally, AI requires leaders to rethink entry-level roles and the future talent pipeline. As automation takes over repetitive tasks, organizations must design early career roles that build exposure, critical thinking, and growth, not eliminate them so that the next generation can still lead. So, teamwork makes the dream work, and we're here to inspire your next collaborative breakthrough. Gather your team or put on your headphones, and let's dive in together.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name's Dane Groeneveld, and today I'm joined by Greg Wilton. Greg is doing some really cool work at the intersection of learning and development, generative AI, and knowledge management. So it's going to be fun diving into all of the changes that are happening right there today. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Thanks, Dane. It's wonderful to be here.
It's a blast. We met only a couple of weeks ago, and I was just blown away by some of the concepts that you were sharing around how much AI is coming to play a role, particularly in how we're enabling humans. I think you called it human enablement. So it's going to be fun diving into that today. Maybe you can give us a little bit more of a picture of how you've come to be working at this particular intersection and at this time in this space.
Yeah, fantastic, Dane. So I really cut my teeth in my profession in the learning and development space. So I started, as an individual contributor, went to being a strategist and leader of associates, leader of teams, working sometimes for global organizations. And so when you're working in e-learning, especially back in the 2010s, early 2010s, so much of that was kind of a one size fits all delivery. And I was constantly looking for ways to elevate the learning objectives beyond just, can you remember some kind of information, into can you make the right choice at the right time? Mm. Oftentimes I would kind of use a framework of can your learner identify the situation, analyze that situation, and take the right action? So identify, analyze, and act. And that tended to produce differentiated learning experiences. And so as I continue to use technology to be able to reach learners at scale, it became really clear as generative AI became really kind of a part of our everyday lexicon that the notion of traditional corporate learning and development was going to adjust as well, meaning that we would be teaching people how to remember concepts or even do basic tasks and go into higher order level thinking. So that meant that learning and development also needed to kind of expand its concept of what it does, inclusive of managing the foundational knowledge or the ground truth that generative AI's bots use to be able to aid them in applying the right choices in the flow of work. And so as I had grown up into directorial level positions in learning and development, I also moved into knowledge management as a way to try to really capture the collective wisdom of the organization that I was working with and be able to make that wisdom accessible in context at the right time. And with that, then we really are building a machine for human enablement, yes. rather than just simply learning and development or getting the right answers at the right time when it comes to knowledge management.
I love that because, you know, having grown up in the oil and gas industry, knowledge management, information management was more like SharePoint and how you make, you know, files available. And it didn't, to me, land in the dynamic way that I'm hearing you describe it as. I love the choice of language there, managing the ground truth of that foundational knowledge.
Which is changing and dynamic all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, particularly now. I mean, there was a time when it was just like, hey, this document has been printed and signed and you have to go and get it from a filing cabinet. And now just think about it, like where we're building as we're flying the plane. So the stuff's emerging, you know, on different projects in different sectors of organizations all of the time.
All the time.
Yeah, that's super cool. And this whole identify, analyze, act piece, that kind of elevated learning objective, as you described it, Greg, I'm intrigued by that because classroom learning seems to have failed a lot of us over the last few decades, and yet we've persisted. So what was it that helped you kind of move into that framing of kind of moving into that flow of work as such?
Sure. So when I was doing that, it kind of happened a little bit by necessity. Mm-hmm. I was an e-learning developer, and I would work with the person commissioning that e-learning course. And, you know, they're not knowledge experts or they're not learning experts. They're experts in their field. And so they would typically want to teach the information in their field.
Yes.
And I was typically constrained to about a 20-minute e-learning course that was typically assigned to hundreds, if not thousands of people.
Yeah.
And as I thought critically about, like, so what are we getting for that investment? The investment of both the development of the course itself, but the real cost is in the people doing the training.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, we've heard a lot about in leadership about needing to move away from a task-oriented mindset for leadership into an outcome-oriented mindset for leadership. Same thing is true in learning and development.
Yes.
You know, so in that case there, I put together an intake methodology that really tried to help distill and really help our subject matter experts speak it in terms of that kind of situational awareness,
mm-hmm.
being able to give us the example, paint us the picture of the scenario that is critical here, and then to help us identify the potential choices or the elements that go into the choice.
Yes.
And, you know, if there are if-then statements, cool, let's get those out on the table. If it's a linear step-by-step process, cool, we can talk about that too. But in the end, you're equipping the people that you're teaching to make a quality decision. And that reframing with my subject matter experts tended to give me the ground truth or the stuff I needed to be able to produce something that our learners could walk away from and feel like they got some real value from it and be able to actually apply that framework in the flow of work. And that's typically when I felt like, okay, I'm onto something with this kind of approach.
That's super neat. Cause I've been to so many of those courses where they're like, you know, you will have lost 20% of what we've taught you today by the time you get home today, and then 40% in 3 days, and then 60% of it's gone by next week. So if you don't start putting this into action, it's kind of lost. So that ability to turn it into action and create repetition and learning, you know, in that flow of work, I think that's it's clearly where we see the better learning working now, but it's definitely the future.
Well, yeah, and frankly, it's always been that case.
Yeah.
for quality instructional design. It's just a matter of, do you feel equipped and confident enough with your subject matter experts to teach them how to teach?
Yeah, that's a really good way to look at it. And I think one thing that I've seen over the last 5 years, having invested in a few of these open source platforms, you know, where you've got lots of different subjects from lots of different instructors, is that it is information. You're getting the best information, but it's not applied to your specific use case of this is how we serve customers or this is how we operate this process line. And therefore, it just doesn't land, even though you've got just access to some of the best minds on these little, you know, LinkedIn Learning, for example. It isn't landing for a lot of people.
Yeah. There's a really well founded construct in knowledge management called the Data Information Knowledge Wisdom Pyramid. It's a very easily Googled concept.
And we'll add that to the show.
It has its boosters and its detractors. But you were talking about how there's a lot of information that's delivered.
Yeah.
But that information is separated from context and practice in many cases. And that's the big dividing line between information and knowledge in that pyramid.
Yes.
Knowledge is elevated when information is combined together and codified through experience to be able to help people make quality decisions and take confident action.
Oh, I love that. And there's also another very human element to this. And I love the way you explained it as human enablement when we were talking the other day, is that we as individual human beings like to come away from the day of work and know that we made some good decisions, that we actually participated in work that was meaningful and mattered not only to ourselves, but to others around us. So if the learning can be deployed in a way where we are actually making good decisions, we're improving the quality of our decisions, we're going to be more productive, but we're also going to feel a lot better about how we're performing at work and what contribution we're delivering.
You'll also, I think you see a lot more confidence in people taking a good risk, because they can still imagine, if they're clear on the outcome and they're confident in the thought process, then that gives them the opportunity to weave in additional information. So for example, like if in that identify, analyze, act kind of scenario, maybe they could take the same analysis that they learned and they can see some parallels in the situation or that identify area.
Yes.
And now they can potentially innovate on that one little situation, which when you're an individual contributor, when you're doing that day-to-day work, if you make that one little improvement, that typically has made your work day.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I love that, because it's kind of ties to that old saying that, structure frees creativity. But by giving them that structure, that confidence, as you describe it, that they're taking a good risk, they're willing to try that one or two extra things.
Right, because they have enough confidence in that knowledge that they learned being applied in a situation that they were able to really understand. So
yeah.
That's, I think, when learning and development is investing in humans in the corporate space, we're doing that.
Yes.
And that's where we are helping to drive that incremental and sometimes groundbreaking innovation if we teach the proper concepts the right way.
Yeah, that's brilliant. As you move into more of the knowledge management, as we were saying earlier, like, there's a lot of things that are happening. There's a lot of incremental innovations happening in the business. So what was built from a learning and development standpoint isn't going to hold as fully true in 6 months or in 6 years. How do you manage that garbage in, garbage out? Like, I think you called it knowledge stewardship. How do you really kind of set the structure and the parameters for what we take forwards?
Sure. So, Dane, for anybody that's listening that doesn't have a lot of background in how generative AI works.
Yeah.
Generative AI is driven by large language models like OpenAI or ChatGPT or Microsoft's Copilot, which is also run off of typically OpenAI's large language models. But these are specialized trained systems that are trained over millions, oftentimes billions of assets, knowledge assets. And so many companies are also looking to harness the benefits of that kind of ChatGPT experience,
mm-hmm.
but with their proprietary information and knowledge. And why wouldn't you, right? So when you do that, you're kind of oftentimes seeing things like, just feed your company documents into our generative AI bot, and then you can prompt, use a chatbot prompt, and then you'll get these wonderful results. And in many cases, they are really wonderful results.
Yeah.
But I think everybody can kind of wrap their head around the idea of garbage in, garbage out. Meaning that if you have poor knowledge assets going into your fundamental ground truth, the thing that your generative AI bot is using to say, like, these are the facts, it's going to produce less quality outputs. But the large language models, because they're so good at imitating human reasoning and human delivery, they can actually present the wrong information with a whole bunch of confidence. And that's what's the hallucination.
Yeah.
And so so then knowledge stewardship is something that I've been kind of trying to play around with. And I've really been inspired by the methods and the structures of data stewardship, which is oftentimes applied to structured data. So if we all can kind of wrap our heads around the idea of garbage in, garbage out, then especially for those of us modeling and leading our people, we have to get much more precise about what we mean, what is garbage,
mm-hmm.
or what is quality, and they both matter.
Yes.
And so I think that knowledge stewardship are really just the rules, the structures, and the behaviors that manage the quality of your ground truth.
I love that. It's funny because I saw a joke on this recently that said if an LLM is only, 80% effective, you see that metaphor out there, like treat it like an intern, like don't just take its work and send it to the customer. Think of it as 80% built. But if it's 80% built and then it's learning off its own materials, then all of a sudden you're down at like 64% once it compounds, and then you're down at sub 50% if it's just constantly, learning on its own work. So that's where the human really comes in with that determination of garbage or quality.
Exactly. And what was quality a while ago can become garbage without you doing anything.
Tell me more about that. That's fascinating.
Sure. For example, for anybody that's working in a regulated industry,
yeah,
we know that regulations change all the time. And so if we were basing our knowledge, our ground truth for our proprietary generative AI,
yeah,
based on things that were true, and then the regulation turns some of that into stuff that's not really true anymore, that's still in your ground truth.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have a system to be able to manage the dynamic methodologies of knowledge, the meaning that a change upstream means that you're going to have to update your knowledge downstream, and you're expecting generative AI to deliver high quality outputs that either improve your speed, your quality, or any other metric that really matters to you,
yeah,
then I really encourage you to inspect your knowledge management practices, the rules for how you manage your knowledge. So for example, if you have a regulatory change, mm-hmm. how can you identify what elements of your knowledge are impacted by that regulatory change?
Yeah.
The structures by which you are managing that ground truth. Like you were saying, like, is it all just a SharePoint site?
Yeah.
Which can actually be effective. I don't want to leave your listeners with a bad taste of SharePoint. They're actually a very good company or platform.
Yeah.
But most importantly is the behaviors. The behaviors for your knowledge creators, whether they be people that are formal content creators that are creating documents and running them through approval queues and things like that, or if they are developing knowledge as a regular part of doing their work. So for example, if you think that you can mine your CRM for some kind of knowledge elements, then you got to make sure that your knowledge is quality when it's going in there in the CRM in the first place. So these are the kinds of things that I've been really wrestling with, Dane, over the last, say, year and a half or so.
Yeah.
The knowledge management practices that can give us quality knowledge going in for better outcomes from our generative AI investments.
Yeah, it is really fascinating, that shift. And I guess it could be regulatory. It could also be competitive. It might be that you've got an offering that was unique or well-priced in the past, and now someone's disrupted your market and you need to shift, how your salespeople are talking about the product and the pricing.
Mm-hmm.
So do you, in that setting, when you've got data, let's say you've got a proprietary data and knowledge management solution that the Gen AI's got access to. Do you tag it? Do you have you got a way of coming back in and finding that primary data, or do you coach the generative AI to say, now I need you to go through and screen out anything that is counter to this latest development?
So Dane, I think both techniques can be useful. So tagging is extremely useful, especially for filtering. You know, so if you have a set of attributes about your knowledge, maybe it's a set of topics, maybe it's an attribute about like document type or something along those lines, tagging can be really effective for you to get quick answers for knowledge stewardship.
Yeah.
But in a dynamic knowledge world, one where maybe a regulatory change actually could hit 3, 4, 10 concepts all at the same time, then getting really good at prompt engineering and being able to ensure that your generative AI tools are being used to, or you're giving them the right instructions to be able to get you quality outcomes at the end. And we can talk a bit about some of those prompt frameworks and such. You know, there's a whole bunch of them out there, but they typically all follow a similar kind of pattern where you define the role that you want that GPT to take.
Yeah.
Whether it, sometimes it's called role, sometimes it's called identity, sometimes it's called a act as, that you give it a explicit task or target action, directions, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
And then you give an output definition. This is the format or the way I want to see it.
Interesting.
And then you can augment it with things like tonality, style. You could also ask it for atypical cases or even things like, if you're not sure, show me some other examples that you think might be included there. And you can also do like things like topic whitelisting to be able to say things like, and exclude anything that has to do with, you know, religion or, you know, some kind of hot topic, hot button topic or things like that. But if you are get really good at structuring your prompts and being that detailed, then you give yourself a much better shot at getting great outcomes from that more probabilistic model that generative AI uses.
That's neat. Actually, I've played with a couple of those, but I really like the way that you outlined kind of the way you build the depth, the breadth and depth of that prompt. Earlier, Greg, you talked about agents. So if I'm hearing you right, you can build a prompt into a, you know, Gen AI and get it to act in a certain way, but you can also build an agent that already operates from some of those groundings or premises. Is that the right way to look at it?
Yeah. So in our like general ChatGPT kind of platforms, it starts kind of with a blank slate there, right? So if we just say like, write me this draft of something, and you know, and maybe just give like a paste, you know, the base notes that you wanted there, then that's a relatively simple task for it to do. But it's not going to come up with much of a really focused kind of outcome.
You know,
so what you're seeing in agents now is a bunch of more hyper focus on specific knowledge, so a more focused ground truth, as well as a more honed and prepared system prompt, or the behind the scenes work that is that's giving the instructions and the expectations for the output. So it's sort of like building in the quality of the output that's specified for the agent. So like, for example, if you had like a legal review agent, for example, you know, the prompt would have some specialty instructions about how to review those legal ground truth versus say something that is like a recipe agent where it's expecting a different format or looking for knowledge in a different type of structure. So as end users, we can make the prompts, and sometimes the agents are also going to have sophisticated prompting behind them.
That is fascinating. makes me think of wanting to build like a librarian or a knowledge management agent that's like, I can ask it a question, hey, bring me the resources that are available, and now just make sure that they fit with that change in regulation or whatever else. There's so many different ways to kind of approach it, I would imagine.
Yeah. And the skills of good leadership really mirror the skills of good prompt engineering.
Right? Interesting. So
when we are our best selves as leaders, we are clear on roles. This is what we're counting on you to do.
Yeah.
We're clear about the action or the outcome that we want them to produce.
Yeah.
We give them appropriate constraints when needed, like format. And we also can coach on what not to do, and you really want to keep it at this style, right? And when we are really good at giving those kinds of proper outcomes and constraints, we free our people to do their best work.
Oh, I love that.
And prompt engineering, you know, has a lot of the same principles to it. You're just helping the machine do its best work.
Yeah. So if I'm hearing you right, then as we upskill leaders to be more AI literate, we're probably reinforcing some of the leadership skills that they need to be adopting in their human team members too.
In my opinion, Dan, absolutely. Study the leaders with great engagement, and I'll bet you'll find that they could be really good prompt engineers too.
Oh, that's a great tip. So, you know, we read these reports like the MIT study that said 95% of generative AI pilots are failing. And I was speaking to a good friend of mine the other day, and he said, part of the problem here is we're overfitting the AI to the human process in the flow of work. But what's probably happening there is we've got some really smart people redesigning the work without the leaders present. And so maybe by your statement just then, go into your organization, map out your best leaders where they are very clear on, you know, outlining roles, outlining outcomes, setting constraints, and then start building some of the AI pilots around them.
Yeah. And you'll find that oftentimes that requires a significant amount of specificity. You know, if we're going into, oftentimes companies will go into do generative AI pilots, and they won't put the remarkable investments that many of the large language model groups have put into building this remarkable model. They think that they can, if they have the tools of retrieval augmented generation, or, you know, they can upload some stuff in there and get an answer, get a quality answer, and they don't put enough constraints around the prompting or what it's supposed to answer.
Yeah.
That becomes a very difficult AI model to test.
Yes.
Right? Because you have just so many potential options. So I think that one of the lessons from that, you know, 95% of pilots failing, is get real tight on the initial use case or the MVP for your generative agent. You know, don't think that it's going to be able to solve a wide range of problems. And if you can't get hyper-specific to the point where you can test the outputs of that model by a factor of 100, by a factor of 1,000, then you're probably building a generative AI bot based on gut.
Yes.
And what business strategy would we ever use that says, like, my measure is my gut?
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't work at that level.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. It does raise a question there, Greg, on this story that we hear about we should stop automating existing business processes and rethink the processes that may now be available with AI. So as you hear that question or statement and you think about that intersection of learning and development, knowledge management and AI, like where would your mind go if you're a leader of a team and you're thinking, well, let's go and try and re-engineer some of the flow of work because of the AI rather than just, you know, replicate.
Sure. Well, I mean, it's sort of like the same kind of concept that you would use to say, like, do we build a better buggy or do we build a car, right?
Yeah.
You know, so inevitably, we will have to rethink our processes with the tools of the trade that we have today. Right. And so So I think that we have to, but there are a couple things that I would say leaders should really be leaning into as they think about those kinds of processes. First thing, I'm sure that many folks have heard the term human in the loop, and yes, when it comes to generative AI. And so for those that may not have, human in the loop is basically the human supervision of AI outputs. You know, but so Dan, you mentioned before in the call or in the podcast here about like treat it like an intern.
Yes.
You know, so don't just take its output and send it to the customer. That's an example of human in the loop, where you have at the right stages, and there could be multiple stages in that process, you have human supervision. And so as oftentimes we talk about human in the loop, but we don't really go into any kind of detail about what that responsibility of the human in the loop is.
Yes.
And I would posit that we start with the skill of critical thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, I think, a no regrets upskill for the use of generative AI. So critical thinking critically about the target outcome that you're looking to produce out of this GPT service. The ability to look for competing evidence that might contradict that output, and be able to actually question the output of the GPT to the GPT.
Yes.
I found multiple times that when I've done that, the GPT has come back with a, oops, you're right, kind of message there too.
I've had one of those just yesterday.
Yeah. It's not infallible, but the better that we as humans get at critical thinking, the better that we can catch those mistakes before they become presented as knowledge or some kind of business output. Because that's where we get into trouble. And then lastly, you know, the ability to think critically about what's missing.
Yes.
You know, so whether that be, you know, some of the things that we've been working on as leaders over the last 5 or 10 years around inclusive leadership. Are we missing perspectives?
Yeah.
Did I miss specificity in the instructions that leaves a what about? You know, so those are all examples of critical thinking that go into supervising the AI output.
So that'd be I like that.
Yeah, so I think that's really important. The other thing that I've been thinking a lot about, because I've got a couple kids that are relatively fresh out of college, is the impact of artificial intelligence and rethinking business processes with artificial intelligence and its impact on the people entering the workforce here in the 2020s. So I think that a quick Google search will help anybody find some of the studies that are coming out recently about its impact. Like there's one from Revelio Labs that I saw today about entry-level jobs in the U.S. being down 35% since 2023.
That's a huge number. Like you mentioned that pre-show and I was flabbergasted. I was like, I can't believe it's that far down.
Yeah. Now, different studies will come up with different numbers for sure.
Yeah.
But there's a consistent trend here that the amount of entry-level jobs are becoming low or lessening, and we're outsourcing some of that repeating tasks that we would normally codify as an entry-level role to generative AI. And to the bottom line, that makes sense. However, I think that we as leaders should be thinking really critically about what should an entry-level role look like in my organization when I put generative AI to work.
Yeah.
Because this is both a practical consideration as well as a moral consideration.
Yeah.
Practically, because the entry level associates of today, some of them will become your frontline leaders in 5 to 10 years. And
absolutely,
if you're not intentional about rethinking the talent pipeline, then I think you're really going to have to pay premiums to hire from the outside for those more senior level roles. Mm-hmm. And morally, we really stagnate the career growth of the next generation if we don't reimagine work. That's not to say that we shouldn't embrace generative AI or agentic AI, but we need to also really think about how we continue to build the talent pipeline when Gen AI is on the scene.
Yeah, That's a brilliant provocation. And actually, it goes a few steps deeper in my mind, because you're right. We've got to think about the cost of replacing that talent that will exit. And, you know, the benefit to like corporate knowledge and memory that comes with developing talent within the org. But let's go a little bit broader societally even. You know, we're not creating healthy communities if we're not creating that opportunity of work. You may actually be damaging some of your employees, because now they have 28 and 30-year-old children, you know, that are still dependent or at home or struggling. And that's a drain. That's an emotional burden on some of our best employees that are parents of that generation. And I'd go a step further, like innovation-wise, as much as there's complaints about the new generation, like they are phenomenally talented and gifted in the way that the world is operating right now. You know, some of our tools, some of our means of building knowledge and consuming knowledge. So I think you're missing out on innovation too. Like they're going to be representative of your largest and most growing consumer segments in the years ahead. So you want to be innovating with them and not excluding them.
Absolutely. So I have a daughter who's 22. She just made a really quick TikTok for her current employer, and it went kind of viral. Like it got 50,000 views. I mean, it really was a significantly larger exposure on the platform for that, for her employer, than they had ever experienced before.
Yeah.
And it's because she knows how to communicate on social media. There's a lot of great talent that maybe some of us in the older generation, we just aren't as engaged with how younger people communicate. That's just an example about how we should be reimagining talent, especially entry-level talent, in the face of generative AI.
And another thought that's very relevant to your field, Greg, is that once upon a time, entry-level talent learned a lot through observation. They'd be in and around doing the more junior tasks, but seeing the more senior people do the work, you know, sitting in the meetings, providing the decks or whatever it was. But now they don't get that proximity. We need to be thinking not only about how are we creating roles for that level of person, but how are we bringing the knowledge to them that they don't get to observe anymore because the flow of work's changing.
Absolutely. That exposure is also a foundation for the critical skill of critical thinking.
Yeah.
Right. You know, so if you don't have exposure to positive and negative exemplars, then it's pretty hard to apply the discipline of critical thinking, because critical thinking is contextual. Hard stop.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's really interesting. So I would imagine that maybe the story is that employers need to be thinking about how their deployment of knowledge management, Gen AI, and learning and development can create more exciting roles to be attracting entry level talent. You know, the good news is if there's less for employers, the good news is if there's less entry level jobs out there, you've probably got the ability to pick from some higher ranking talent coming into the organization. So why not equip them to do more on the team and you know, be touching you know, areas of the business that maybe weren't traditionally the case for first and second year employees.
Sure. Simply just doing knowledge management could be a really great opportunity for entry level talent, because it is an example of observing knowledge. It also has a really important role in maintaining that knowledge, which then also feeds the critical thinking that then can go into the human in the loop kind of roles, where you can start to supervise that knowledge and then eventually move up into more strategic applications, because you're able to synthesize more knowledge from various points of information faster to make better decisions. So Dan, I'm really glad you said that, because that kind of just synthesized some looser thoughts that I had about you know, the societal role of knowledge management and how it can affect entry-level work.
It's super cool. And I would imagine that has a connotation for the LLMs too, because as industry veterans, we tend to talk a lot in jargon, and we tend to talk a lot about certain situations without providing the full context. And so as you've got entry-level people coming into the organization who don't have that, I think you called it earlier, context, Yeah, I think it was, you know, they don't have that context and perhaps some of the variables that are going into that knowledge, then they're probably going to be questioning it and simplifying the language, creating a bit more explanation, which means that the LLMs are probably being fed more complete data to build the knowledge from.
Yeah, absolutely. So as generative AI really makes, kind of automates the creation of first drafts in many cases, this is also an opportunity to rethink entry-level roles for content creation. And the role of subject matter expert, maybe they need to move from being authors to more being approvers.
Editors, approvers. Yeah, I like
and
that.
And mentors, right?
Yeah.
And so it could be another great example of leveraging the power of generative AI, but also maintaining and creating talent pipeline systems that really embrace the technology, as well as that important role of keeping your culture.
Yeah. And I've seen a lot on that in conversation over the last few weeks, this whole concept of learning agility, and we need to be hiring not for skills. Like there's been this big shift towards skills-based hiring, and skills-based hiring may actually have already kind of had its moment, because a lot of those skills in the pre-AI world are going to shift fundamentally in the next couple of years. So you need to be hiring for that learning agility. How can you bring someone in who knows how to work with the generative AI, and actually take forward, you know, emerging business practices.
Absolutely. And when you
that's cool.
That's when you have that, making a high performing team becomes so much easier.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that I continue to find through these conversations, is that the more you can focus your team on process steps and excellence in the process steps, the more consistently they can scale both hiring and onboarding new people, but making those innovation steps that you touched on earlier. So, confidence, commitment, camaraderie, and competence kind of all come together then in that team environment.
Without a doubt.
Cool. Well, we've covered some really awesome ground today, Greg, from those early days of like elevating learning objectives to be more about identify, analyze, and act. You know, help teams make good quality decisions. Don't just like give them knowledge, you know, off the shelf. I love the way that you talk about the importance of managing the ground truths, that foundational knowledge in the organization. And that actually by doing that in the flow of work, it allows you to kind of harness that collective wisdom. That was a really cool, framing that you laid out there. As we kind of move further in that concept of creating the confidence within which people can be taking a good risk and maybe mix in a few new ingredients, I think you're inviting more team members into the innovation loop, which is super cool. And as we moved on to prompt engineering, I honestly think that was the highlight of the conversation, that, you know, good leaders that create those clear expectations on role and outcome and constraints build good prompts. So maybe that's where we should be focusing some of our, you know, AI innovation, around those already existing good leaders and their teams. So that was super cool. And then this final point on like, what are the implications here for our future talent pipelines, and how can we maybe better leverage the skills that are coming in from that Gen Z workforce? I think it's definitely something that should be more front of mind for more of our team leaders. So, a really cool conversation. If any of our listeners want to reach out and find you and learn a little bit more about some of your approaches here or where you're getting your inspiration, what's the best way for them to connect?
Thanks, Dan. I'm really open to having conversations. You can find me on LinkedIn, Greg Wilton. It's linkedin.com/in/Greg-Wilton.
Perfect. Well, thanks for your time today, Greg. I look forward to checking in again soon to see how this whole movement's progressing.
Dan, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Just a quick note before we go. The views and opinions shared in this episode are those of our guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the host, Dane Gruneveld, the Leader Group, our patron Huddle 3, or our partners and affiliates. Any scenarios discussed are for the purpose of fueling creative thinking and conversation, and should be viewed only in this context. Dane, Leader, our sponsors, partners, and affiliates do not endorse any guest or any organization they may be associated with. It's important to remember that every workplace is as individual as the people within it. Our recommendation is to always seek solutions that are specifically designed to help serve your team's unique needs. And to this point, please know we're here, ready to help you find the best way forward, no matter where your starting point is. You can connect with Dane or myself, Alicia McCraw, on LinkedIn or via the links contained in the show notes. Thanks again for tuning in. And hey, if you think someone in your network would benefit from this episode, feel free to share it or give us a 5-star rating. Those 5 little stars really help us reach more curious people like you. We'll catch you next time on the Future of Teamwork.